Good evening, guys. How's it going? So we're going through a big change here. It's something to get used to. This is Apologetics.com Radio. And if you're listening to us, first and foremost, you guys need to give us a call at 888-995-5552. That's our phone number because we are live right now. Is it Friday night or is it Saturday morning, Dr. Wickman?
It's Saturday morning.
So it's Saturday. So it's evening slash night. It's midnight. And we would love for you to call us and keep us awake because that's why we do the show. We do this show for you guys. Like I said, this is Apologetics.com Radio where we challenge believers to think and thinkers to believe. And we've gone through a big change because there is a live broadcast now before us. So guess what we had to do? We had to rush into the studio and get all our stuff ready. I blame Daniel. Daniel, this is your fault, and I don't appreciate it at all. Now, Daniel is our engineer, and he's behind the glass, and he does such an amazing job for us, and I'm so thankful for all the people here at KKLA, and even more so, I am thankful for you guys for joining us, because tonight is a very special night. It's always a special night when we're on. I'm John. I'm nobody, but I'm here with Dr. Leslie Wickman, who is somebody. You're an amazing individual. She is, oh my gosh, I always mess up. You're not the president.
Executive director.
She is the main person over at the ASA, American Scientific Affiliation, and they are the sponsor of our show, and we are really thankful for them, too. If you guys are listening, you've never been to the ASA's website. It's ASA3.com.
O-R-G.
O-R-G.
We're a nonprofit, so we're a .org.
They are a .org because they're a nonprofit. And they sponsor this the third Friday or Saturday, depending on how you look at the third Saturday, yeah. Technically. You guys sponsor every single week or every single month. And we come on live to talk about issues relating with Christianity and science.
Exactly.
And we deal with some heavy stuff. So, okay, you guys, if you're listening, you need to go to www.asa3.org, asa3.org,
yep.
And you need to check it out because there are I'm talking miles
of
resources
yeah,
for
absolutely.
You. And so what's going on with the ASA these days?
Well, the big thing is coming up, our annual meeting in July. So July, the weekend of July 19th through 23rd-ish. We're having our annual meeting at Wheaton College in Illinois.
That's amazing.
And
deep dish pizza.
Yeah, baby.
Deep science. I like it.
Yeah, so we're really excited about that. The theme is exploring creation. So we got all kinds of stuff going on as far as looking at God's good creation.
I love that. And I feel like recently, at least in my circles that I travel in, which are limited, I feel like creation has been a big topic of discussion for some reason lately. And I feel like oftentimes it's a distraction to us because we get lost in the minutia of the conversation and we lose touch or we lose track of the fact that there is a designer God. There's a God who created it all. In the beginning, God.
Yeah. You know, and the thing is, the way, I tend to look at creation is God's second book of Revelation. So he reveals himself not only through scripture, but also through what he's created.
That's right.
And it's fascinating to see how both books relate to each other and support each other and show us more about who this great God is.
I love that. And God has revealed himself in three ways, right? Through the person, the work of Jesus Christ, through the scriptures, that is his special revelation. And then the third way, or not in order of rank at all, but the third is his general revelation, which is the world around us. Mm-hmm. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim his handiwork.
Absolutely.
Which actually kind of leads us. Well, I first want to actually just say that people need to get to this conference.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
I'm gonna talk to my wife tomorrow morning to see if we can go to the conference.
Awesome.
Which would be really rad. And then maybe you and I could go live or at least record some podcasts.
Yeah, exactly.
From there.
That'd be really sweet.
Yeah, and you guys can sign up. You can it's free to attend.
Well,
what's the cost?
It's free. We have scholarships available for students. But there is a registration fee for people to attend. And if you sign up sooner rather than later, we have the early early bird discount that's wrapping up. Actually, it may have just wrapped up this weekend.
Uh-oh.
And then we have the night owl discount after that. And then you, after that,
night
you
play, owl.
And then you, after that, you have to pay the full price. So the sooner you register, the better the price you're going to get.
Yeah. And either way, no matter what, it's worth it. And the money goes towards a really good cause too. So it's not just wasted money either.
Yeah.
And the conference, I mean, you're talking about having the best of the best speak to you on scientific issues. These people are not only good apologists, but they, I mean, these people who are working in their fields.
Exactly.
So they're practically living out their faith.
Yes.
And they have a lot to add to the to any conversation. During these times, do you guys have like question and answer sessions at all?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, I mean,
pretty much almost every single talk that is given at the conference will have time for Q&A.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So you have like these amazing professors and experts in the field, authors and presenters. And so they're presenting on the stuff that they're most passionate about, that they are most knowledgeable about. And then you can ask them the questions that you have.
Yeah, exactly.
That's one of the best things about conferences is like I always look at the programs beforehand. There's a few conferences I go to every year. Mm-hmm. And I always look at the programs beforehand and map out, you know, how am I going to get to where I need to go? I want to see this speaker. And then you weigh them out. You weigh them. Oh, man, I really wish I could see this, but this is going at the same time. But the best part is interacting.
Yeah, absolutely.
And bringing your questions.
Yeah, and not even just interacting with the speakers, but the conversations that take place around the meal tables and at coffee breaks and things like that are often the things that people write home about. You know what I mean?
So, like, are the other speakers and presenters oftentimes out there about, like, mingling with
absolutely.
With the commoners?
Yes. And, I mean, bear in mind, we have about, I think, 5 or 6 plenary speakers. And then we also have dozens of contributed talks that happen too. And so, you know, you're bound to share a meal with somebody who's given a talk. And even just, you know, for the kind of fellowship. In fact, that's one of the things that people think is one of the best features of the ASA is the fellowship with believers who look at God's creation as a way that he reveals to us about himself.
Yeah, and one of the things that I really love about the ASA is the diversity that's represented in the views and what's presented. It's not just like, you know, you're not just going to hear one view.
Right.
You're going to hear across a spectrum
exactly.
of people. So you guys can I like learning from other people that I don't agree with necessarily.
Yeah.
So it provides that great opportunity.
Yeah, exactly. We call ourselves a big tent organization.
Yeah.
So we have various views on science, various views on origins, various denominations represented, various disciplines. So we are a big tent in many ways. And as you said, you know, it's an opportunity for us to exchange ideas with people who don't think exactly the same way we do about any particular things.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So you guys got to go. You got to go to the meeting. It's in Wheaton, Illinois.
Yeah, on the campus of Wheaton College. So
it's going to be unbelievable.
Yeah, there's a lot of cool features at Wheaton College itself, too. The Billy Graham Library is there.
C.S. Lewis Library.
Cool.
Is there?
Is it really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, very cool.
Oh, yeah.
Awesome.
I'd go there.
Yeah, me
That's
too.
Where I'd go. Well, I'd first go to the conference.
Yeah.
And then I'd go to the CS because the CS Lewis Library is not going anywhere,
right?
You know, but no, the it's going to be a great time.
Yeah.
And so make sure you guys register. You can go to www.asa3.org and register right now. I'm on the website right now. It's up and running, and you can click on the there's a top banner that says for conference information, and there's a full conference passes that are available to you, and the early bird is passed, so you are late to the party, but that's okay. There's still some tickets, so
exactly.
Make sure you get involved in this, guys. And now tonight, just by way of introduction, we're talking about a really interesting topic tonight, and so I have a bunch of questions about this. I haven't even talked to Dr. Wickman about, so we'll see how it goes. But we're going to talk about the question: is life in the universe common, or are we alone?
Yeah.
So, what do you think?
What do I think?
What do you think? You're the expert.
Okay, well, I think we should actually kind of explore the territory a little bit before we decide what I think.
Let's just answer the question, and then we can, And I do want to throw out just before we get into this, If you have questions about life in the universe, if you have questions about origins, if you have questions about anything having to do with are we alone, you need to call us tonight because that's what we're talking about. It's 888-995-5552. And I'm here with Dr. Leslie Wickman, and she knows what she's talking about.
Well, thanks. Yeah, this is something that I actually had a conversation with my students about not long ago. So it's certainly a hot topic, and it goes all the way from the serious scholarly research that people at NASA and academic institutions do to some of the less serious speculation about aliens and UFOs. But tonight, for the most part, I think I'd like to stick to the more serious issues of whether it makes sense.
That takes away my question. I was going to ask you, so Dr. Wickman, have little green men ever visited our planet? But that'll have to be next time.
Okay. All right. Hold that thought. So
I like serious. Serious is good.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, one of the biggest questions comes when we start thinking about the vastness of the universe. And, you know, just to put some of the ideas about the universe in perspective, on the clearest night, we can only see about 2,000 stars with the naked eye when we look up at the sky. But powerful telescopes have revealed literally billions. And there are an estimated 10 billion galaxies with around 100 billion stars each, meaning that there are approximately a billion trillion stars in the observable universe.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? It's
also crazy when you put in context, like everything passes through the lens of scripture for me. So Psalm 147 says that God determines the number of the stars and calls them each by name.
Yeah. Yeah, it is quite amazing. One of the analogies that I use to kind of help my students get their brains around some of these really big numbers is the idea of if you were to make one dot per second with a pencil, and you were to do this 24 hours per day, it would take 32 years and several hundred pencils just to make 1 billion dots. So
get going.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, I mean, the vastness of the universe is really impossible for most of us to even begin to get our brains around.
And it's growing, right? I mean,
yeah, it's expanding. It absolutely is. And the edges of just the observable part of the universe are about 46 billion light years away in every direction.
Wait, okay. Say that again. I'm trying to.
The edges of the observable universe, so what we can actually theoretically see, are about 46 billion light years away in every direction.
That's incomprehensible.
Yeah, and that's what we could theoretically see, okay? But
I literally have nothing to say to that, which is really odd because normally I have something to say to everything. Ask my wife. So, but like,
I know
that's
you well
incredible.
Enough to be able to affirm that.
Yes,
too.
You know that's incredible.
Yeah, it is. It really is. And it's really hard to get your brain around numbers like that and sizes like that. So, but to bring this back to the topic at hand, as to, you know, whether we're alone or if there are others that are intelligent beings in the universe, you know, the idea being that if this place is so huge, if the universe is so big, you know, it's easy to let your mind go to, you know, maybe there are other intelligent beings somewhere out there if this place is so big. And that's kind of the direction a lot of people go with this.
Interesting. And I have so many questions. I just want to kind of go through what we got, and then I'll ask my questions.
Okay. Okay. So, and then kind of taking the next step in this thought experiment, so to speak. You know, we've discovered literally thousands now of extrasolar planets, or planets that are around other stars than our sun.
Mm-hmm.
And probably many of the sun-like stars could support planetary systems. All of our space exploration so far has shown that our neighbors in space are not remotely capable of sustaining life of any complexity. So just being slightly bigger or smaller than the Earth, or a little closer or further from your star, makes a dramatic difference in whether or not a planet is habitable. So a lot of what we're looking at when we discover these exoplanets, or the extrasolar planets, planets around other stars, is how far they are from their star.
Yep.
In other words, are they in the habitable zone of their star?
Goldilocks zone.
Right, which gives it the precise temperature that it needs.
Yep.
But another basic factor is how big the planet is.
Yeah.
Right? And so we're looking for planets that are close to the size of the Earth. But, you know, in general, what we're talking about is not exactly the size of the Earth. We're just looking for ones that are kind of in the range of the size of the Earth, rather than being a giant planet like Jupiter would be.
Yeah, sure.
Right. But the thing is, the more we look at the parameters that have to be just exactly right, we start to realize that really the planet needs to be pretty much exactly the size of Earth in order to give it the right gravity to hold on to the right kind of atmosphere and elements. So, for example, we've talked about this before.
Yeah.
But
like
Earth's gravity, Earth's gravity has to be strong enough to hold on to water vapor at 18 grams per mole.
Yeah.
But not strong enough to hold on to large amounts of methane and ammonia at 16 and 17 grams per mole. So you can't, if you have a planet that's just a little bit bigger with stronger gravity, it's going to hold on to methane and ammonia and be poisonous,
yeah.
Right? And if it's a little bit smaller than the Earth, it's not, its gravity is not strong enough to hold on to water vapor, which is necessary for the water cycle. So,
and when we're talking size of these planets, we're talking like, I mean, the differences are so small between 18 grams per mole and 17 grams per
mole.
Right,
exactly.
You can't even really wrap your mind around these differences.
Yeah, it's balanced on a knife's edge.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, that's right. That's amazing.
Yeah.
And we've talked about this a lot. And and then, so how does this stuff that we're talking about, it's like the Earth seems finely tuned, like where we are. I mean, we're talking even not just the mass of the Earth, the size of the sun, the distance from the sun to the planet. We're talking tilt on the axis,
for seasons,
and all
right,
this stuff.
Having the right atmospheric components, as well as components of the Earth itself, the crust and whatnot. I mean, there's so many things that have to be just exactly right. And so, really, the only things that we can detect about these extrasolar planets are their distance from the sun and generally how big they are.
Yeah, because we're looking so far away.
Yeah. Well, I mean, sometimes we can detect a little bit about atmospheric composition also. If we can get some light that's shining through the atmosphere, we might be able to figure something out about the atmospheric composition.
So whether or not what elements are prominent, but depending on how the light is shining back at us, because those elements will reflect the light differently.
You basically, you've got to have a straight on view to be able to see these things, right? And again, they're typically so far away that we're not going to be able to get too much detail.
Yeah, the odds aren't good.
Yeah.
For this to happen,
yeah.
You know, the odds aren't like if you were playing the lottery, like, or if you were betting on this, I wouldn't bet on the fact that there's a planet just like ours.
Yeah. I mean, it takes a lot to get a planet just like Earth. And again, you know, I mean, if we just look around our own solar system, we see, you know, on the one hand, we have Venus that is just a little tiny bit smaller than the Earth, but it's a little closer to the sun,
yeah,
too. And, you know, its surface temperature on average is like 900 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's hot.
Yeah. It's got 90 times the atmospheric pressure.
Yeah. Oh, and that's, yeah.
Yeah.
It would hurt your ears.
It's got an atmosphere that's primarily carbon dioxide, ooh, laced with sulfuric acid.
Which would make it hurt to breathe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, so
uninhabitable.
Yeah, exactly. And then we look the other direction to Mars, being a little further away from the sun and smaller, and it's not habitable either because it doesn't have enough atmosphere. It doesn't have a breathable atmosphere. It doesn't have an oxygen atmosphere. It's got CO2, and it's about 1/100th of the density of Earth's atmosphere.
And Mars is something you know quite a bit about because you're like, you've worked on the Mars rover and all that stuff. And so can I just ask, like, it might be a stupid question, but whatever, you're gonna do it anyway, so might as well. So then what is the significance of us finding even just like a single cell organism living on Mars? Like, why are people freaking out if that is a possibility?
Well, I mean, the idea of getting life is a whole extra layer of complexity in terms of what has to happen. Okay. So we will get to that a little bit later in the show.
Okay, cool.
I'm jumping ahead. Yeah, the thing is though, I mean, the idea of you know, how does life arise anywhere? Okay. And the idea of trying to get life from non-life is incredibly complex.
That's hard.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So if we were to see another place where that actually happened, that would be a really big deal.
That would be a big deal.
Really big deal.
But for me, and like you said, we might get to this later, but for me, it doesn't necessarily seem like you're getting life from non-life because we have life already in the universe.
Right.
So if we detect life somewhere else, it doesn't necessarily mean it's coming from non-life.
It does. Well, it doesn't mean that other life would have had to come from non-life, but at least it at one time, presumably,
could have.
To get life in a purely physical universe without anything living, at some point you had to get life from non-life.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. This whole subject is so fascinating to me, maybe because I don't fully understand it. You know, it's one of those things that I know enough just to be dangerous, mm-hmm. but it makes me really think, cause like everybody else, I think, like, you know, as a kid, you know, I used to lay in the street. Well, we used to play this game. Anyways, we used to lay down on the ground and we look up at the stars.
Sure.
Where did it all come from?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. And I mean, one of the ideas that goes around out there is this idea of transpermia, which basically says, well, life didn't necessarily arise even on the Earth, that it came from someplace else in space.
Yeah, like a media carrying some life landed.
But all that does is really kind of transfer the problem to some other location, right? You still had to at some point get life from non-life in a physical universe.
Yeah. And we've never seen that.
Right.
Ever.
Yeah.
Like in science.
Yeah. So again, the Earth itself is pretty unique in terms of the environmental aspects it provides to support and sustain life.
Yeah.
Right. And so.
So we know the basic conditions that need to exist in order to support life. Mm-hmm. And we know that the odds are very, very, very slim in finding that anywhere else but here. And then that kind of like leads us, I think, to the next kind of point with the next couple minutes before our break to maybe introduce, like, cause we don't just give up, mm-hmm. we're searching.
Yeah.
And we've been searching for a while.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how did that come about and what is that currently?
Right. So I think you're referring to the SETI search. So the search for extraterrestrial intelligence has been searching the skies for radio signals since 1978. So that's like 41 years.
Why radio?
Well, so just as we in a
poor
technological...
Poor Dr. Wickman, you have to answer all my questions that aren't in our notes, by the way. Just so you guys know, I ask the questions that aren't in the notes.
Yeah, which is why we never get through all the material.
I know.
In a particular show. But anyway...
But so, I know if I'm thinking the question,
yeah,
there's
sure,
other people
no,
out there that
good.
Are thinking
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
absolutely. So why radio?
Right. As in our technological civilization, we transmit radio waves to communicate, right? So we've been doing that since when did radio become a thing?
Back turn of the 19th century, yeah.
Okay.
Right, I think, earlier?
I think it was about, early 1900s.
Yeah, I think
that's
so.
That's about right. So the assumption is that any other technological civilization would also be transmitting radio waves. They're low energy. And anyway, so you don't, they don't require a lot of energy to transmit signal.
Yeah.
And
1899.
Okay. We were right on it.
Right on it.
Very good.
I mean, that's like on the nose.
Yes. That's we're good. Impressive.
We're super impressive. we are impressive people. Anyways, all right, keep going.
So anyway, so SETI has been listening to the sky for 41 years now, and they've not yet detected anything that could be remotely construed as an intelligence signal.
I love
signal.
That. I mean, what's their budget?
I'm not really sure, actually. I think it's decreasing.
I hope so, because like this is U.S. tax dollars here. I mean, I hope so, and I don't. Anyways, that was a
yeah,
joke.
No, but many of the SETI researchers acknowledge a low probability for discovering an intelligent signal, but they're convinced that such a discovery would be so profound that it's worth the effort and the expense.
And I agree.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I agree.
It would be pretty amazing.
Yeah. I have more questions, but I'll hold off. Let's go.
Okay. So the next thing I think we should talk about briefly, at least, is the Drake equation. And the original Drake equation came about in roughly 1968, I think it was, by astrophysicist Frank Drake. And he came up with it, or actually 1961, I think. And he came up with it to try to calculate the probability that there might be other intelligent civilizations in the Milky Way galaxy.
Yeah. It's like a big, long equation.
Yeah.
So, we're coming up to a break. Before we come to the break, is this an equation that was a product of SETI? Or did it exist before SETI? Do you know?
No, I think this was completely separate SETI.
From SETI. Okay,
but,
cool.
I mean, SETI, I'm sure, has been interested in it and you know, using it and that sort of thing. But yeah, so we'll talk a little bit more about that maybe after the break.
Absolutely. And we are coming up to our hard break right here. So we're going to be gone for about 60 seconds. Make sure you stay tuned. You're listening to Apologetics.com Radio, where we challenge believers to think and thinkers to believe. I'm John Noyes. I'm with Dr. Leslie Wickman from the ASA. And keep tuning in because we're talking about some really interesting stuff. And I look forward to being back in about 60 seconds. Well, you guys, I'm so proud of you because you made it through the break. You made it through the break. And if you did that, that means you are now still listening to Apologetics.com Radio, where we challenge believers to think and think as to believe. We are live right now broadcasting from Glendale, California. So that means if you're listening online, we've had callers call in from, I mean, Staten Island, New York. We've had people from Hawaii. We've had people, I've had one caller from Korea.
Wow.
So, I mean, you guys can give us a call. And the way that you would do that is you'd pick up the phone and you would dial 1, because that's our country code, and you dial 888-995-5552. And now that only goes for you if you're listening right now, and I'm talking at 12:30 a.m. on Saturday morning, the 18th of January, February, March, April, May 2019. So you are listening live to us. And we really do want to hear from you because my name is John Noyes. I'm nobody and I'm just having some fun. But I am here with Dr. Leslie Wickman, who is like a huge big deal. People don't understand this about you, Dr. Wickman. You have a book that people should go on Amazon and buy, right? God of the Big Bang.
Sure.
And then not only that, but you are a college professor. You're also like the big boss at the ASA, the American Scientific Association. You're a sought-after speaker, a presenter. You're just an you're like a semi-pro volleyball player. I mean, you have like everything on your resume. It's unbelievable. She's like blushing and she doesn't want to talk about any of this stuff because, know what? We have a lot to talk about, not just your resume.
Yes.
But there is a lot to talk about. Tonight, right now, we're talking about, stuff that you're kind of like an expert in, you know, and that you've studied for a really long time. And it's, is there life out there? And we've just, we've covered a lot of information in the last half hour. I'm hoping to cover even more this half hour. So we've gone from the plausibility really of finding another planet that exists that's similar to ours, meaning it's similar distance to a similar star, with similar composition atmospherically and in gravity. And so it's the same size, the same mass, everything from the way it's tilted towards the sun, everything from what's made up, like the elements in the atmosphere. And it's rare, we've come to. Yeah. And we've gone, now we've talked about SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial intelligence.
Yeah.
And so that's a government program where they're just basically listening. It's not.
Yeah, I don't think it's a government program. I think they're kind of a separate.
It's privately funded.
Organization. I think so. I think
if you're donating to SETI, you should start donating to apologetics.com and ASA. Because exactly. We will find that life for you. No. So, anyways, we talked about SETI, where what they do is basically they're pointing radio telescopes. Is that right?
Mm-hmm,
into the remote space. They are monitoring a small fragment of space because space is so incredibly big. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to see if they detect anything. And so far to date in 41 years,
exactly. They haven't found anything that remotely resembles an intelligent signal. But you think about it too. So in 41 years, since radio waves travel at the speed of light, we've basically looked 41 light years out into space, which is not very much when you look at the whole
size
of the universe.
I mean, it's a fraction.
It is a very small.
Like 2% or whatever. Yeah, it's not even. Not even close.
It's really, really small.
Yeah, so I have a question. Because there's John in Pasadena who has a question. And he has some thoughts on this. So we're going to take a caller right now. And this is, I'm going to pick up on John in Pasadena. Hey, John, are you with us?
Yes.
John, thank you so much for giving us a call. You have a fantastic first name, I just have to say, because that's my first name. Well, my name's Jonathan, but know what? We can find commonality. It's good.
Yeah.
And so you have a thought on the habitable planet conversation is what the node I see. So what's your thought?
Well, I've been following Dr. Hugh Ross, an astrophysicist. You may be acquainted with him.
Yep.
He's a smart dude.
But he's done an excellent survey of scientific literature. He relies on good studies and credible research. And he's concluded that in putting all the factors together and even reducing the or giving some favorable reductions for cross correlations and all that, that the probability of there being any planet at all in the universe that would support any form of advanced life more than just microbes is very remote. That even if you assume there's 10 to the 22nd planets in the universe, which is a generous estimate, the probability of any planet from natural processes being capable of supporting advanced life would be, in the latest estimate, 10 to the 1,050th power, one chance in 10 with 1,050 zeros after it.
Yeah,
and that there's a extremely naive ideas. I heard of one fellow named Adam Frank that recently estimated there were billions of civilizations in the universe, and these people go from the most simplistic idea, say, well, gosh, there's only a little tiny fraction of 1%, then all you need is a Goldilocks zone and water, and presto, there's going to be life there.
Yeah.
These are they never really examine the details, but if you put all the details together, it's basically essentially a zero likelihood that any planet would exist be based on the natural factors. And that the fact that we have the conditions here on Earth is only explainable by divine creation. That's the only credible explanation. If you really look comprehensively and objectively at all the science.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to hear what the doctor has to say here, Dr. Leslie Wickman.
Yeah, actually, I know Hugh very well, and actually he and I have co-presented at conferences together. I think that, he definitely knows his stuff. And we are trying to basically, in this talk tonight, we want to look at kind of the two sides of the argument in terms of, those that argue that life is common and what their points are, and those who argue that life is rare. And the life is rare arguments include a lot of what you're just talking about, John. So we'll come back to that shortly in this presentation. But yeah.
Yeah, and I love that. And I love what you pointed out here. The number that I've heard of the number that I've heard for all the everything to line up perfectly for life to exist would be 1 in 100 million, trillion, 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 trillion. And that's actually, so that's not my number. That's Roger Penrose. And he's a mathematician out of Oxford. And he actually says this. He says, if we combined all the laws that must be fine-tuned, and he's not a Christian, as far as I know. I don't think he's a Christian. I could be wrong, but I don't think he is. But if he says, if we combined all the laws that must be fine-tuned, we couldn't even write down that number in full, since it would require more zeros than the number of elemental particles in the universe.
That's close to what Dr. Ross is saying. Yeah, that.
We have Dr. Ross, Dr. Penrose, and Dr. Remote. Wickman.
What?
We have Dr. Ross, Dr. Penrose, and Dr. Wickman all agreeing that life is rare.
Yeah. Oh, in principle, yeah. In fact, well, yes, and it's so rare that the probability that it would ever would arise out of natural processes is essentially zero.
It's almost zero. And hey, John, thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate it. And we're gonna start talking about the Drake equation. So stay in there, and I'd love to hear again from you. Thank you for listening, John. And we really appreciate it. So have a good night. And Dr. Wickman, I mean, life is rare. And so we were talking about how life is rare, and there's certain principles that people use. There's calculations that people use to see how rare, and one of them is the Drake equation.
Mm-hmm.
And what exactly is that?
Yeah, so the Drake equation, as I mentioned before, is from astrophysicist Frank Drake back in 1961. He used it to calculate the probability that there are other technological civilizations within the Milky Way galaxy. And so he takes...
technological means advanced to be able to communicate.
Advanced
like
enough
that.
to be able to detect radio signals and that sort of thing. So to basically make us aware of their presence.
Sure.
In a sense, okay. So the Drake equation combines three terms from astronomy: the frequency of star formation, the fraction of those stars that host planets, and the number of planets with environments that are suitable for life. So all of those things, obviously, are things that the Earth got right.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then he combines three biological terms, including the fraction of such planets with any life of any sort, and the fraction that might have developed intelligent life, and the fraction of civilizations capable of making their presence known.
F sub C.
Yeah. And then the seventh term indicates how long these civilizations might maintain the technology needed to make their presence known. So how long did they last before they went extinct? Yeah. Right?
And if you're listening, guys, you have to look up the Drake equation, because it's really fun to look at. I'm having a good time just looking at it. I'm looking at a graphic that Dr. Wickman sent me before the show. And did you create this, or is this something that can be Googled?
No, that you can Google that.
So if you Google the Drake equation, there's some pretty cool graphics that have good explanatory power. You can understand what it means.
Yeah. And so the more recent take on this is actually kind of coming at it from the opposite direction. And actually, our caller, John, just mentioned one of the researchers that was involved in this kind of new equation, Frank Drake. Frank Drake was the original guy. Adam Frank from University of Rochester and Woodruff Sullivan at University of Washington.
These guys are super smart.
Yeah, they kind of went at it from the other direction, and they essentially took the idea that we know that there is one technological civilization in the universe, that being us here on planet Earth, right? So they start with that. So A represents the number of known intelligent technological civilizations in the universe. That's us.
One.
And then N is the number of extrapolated habitable zone planets within observable space, basically taking the exoplanets that we have discovered and using that density in space, extrapolating to the observable universe. And so then with those two known numbers, you basically are able to take A, which is one, divided by the number of habitable zone planets in the universe, and come up with F, which is a fraction or a frequency of planets that are habitable in the entire universe. Okay, so the result, based on the number of exoplanets that have been discovered so far, extrapolated to the entire universe, basically says that if Earth is the only technologically advanced civilization, then it means that life happens at least every 10 billion trillion habitable zone planets, or one technological civilization in 10 to the 22nd habitable zone planets, because 10 to the 22nd is the estimated number of habitable zone planets in the universe.
And that's a really small number.
It's a very small number. And so essentially what they were doing is saying, okay, it's at least this many.
Yeah.
Right? So it's kind of establishing a low-end threshold, right?
But like, it's a ridiculously small number.
Yeah, it's a ridiculously small number. But their point, really, their point is that, you know, if we discover that, you know, either there are more technological civilizations out there, then it that fraction goes up, if you will, or if we discover that there are fewer habitable zone planets in the universe, then that fraction goes up too.
Yeah.
Right?
So, yeah.
So anyway, so the whole point was to establish a low-end threshold on how frequently this happens.
And just kind of a tertiary question here is, do you know where those two scientists, Frank and the other guy, where are they on the you know, religious spectrum? Are they believers?
Not that I know of, no. Yeah. I mean, these guys are, you know, they're working in essentially the, you know, secular community.
So this is the data. I mean, this is what this is science,
right?
Being worked out. It's not, you know, it's not being skewed because these guys are Bible thumpers. They're not going out trying to prove the Bible,
right? Right.
And which is really interesting, because even secular scientists, I mean, they're coming to the same conclusions that what I would as a non-scientist.
Yeah. Although it's interesting. I mean, there's a subtle twist here, and I don't mean twist in a pejorative way.
Yeah.
What I mean is that there is this kind of hopefulness about it, to say, okay, they're at least one in 10 to the 22nd,
sure,
right? So they're basically saying that they're at least this many, and maybe there are more. You know what I'm saying?
Have you, Dr. Wickman, have you ever seen the movie Dumb and Dumber?
Yes.
Okay. So there's a scene in the movie Dumb and Dumber where Lloyd Christmas is standing in front of Mary. He chases Mary across the country, right? He's trying to chase this girl to return her briefcase. And he's standing in the lobby of a hotel, if I remember correctly. And he's saying to you, like, hey, what are the chances? What are the chances of a guy like me and a girl like you getting together? And she goes, oh, Lloyd, not good. And he's like what? Like 1 in 100? And she thinks, and she pauses, and she goes, more like 1 in 1,000,000. And he like seems to, like, his face like expression changes, and all of a sudden he smiles. He says, so you're saying there's a chance.
Exactly. You know?
And it's like the most ridiculous thing. And everybody laughs. Like, I use it in my presentation that I do on this subject, and everybody laughs, and I stop everybody and say, why are you laughing? Mm-hmm. Everybody laughs, no matter where you are on the religious, like what you believe, everybody laughs because you know that's ridiculous. And we're talking 1 in 1,000,000.
Yeah.
We're not talking 1 in 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,
yeah, they're acknowledging that at least for what we know right now, it is a very remote possibility. That's right. At least it's a possibility.
Right. Like said, right? So the door is still open to crack. Yeah. But no, what's really funny is I feel like for me, like I said, I'm a lay person here. I'm a philosopher, not a scientist. But for me, it seems like as time goes on, we discover more and more things, and that fraction is getting smaller and smaller. So that crack in the door is closing smaller and smaller, but we still hold out. Well, they still hold out hope.
Well, and even the calculations that we're basing this on right now are pretty generous, if you will, in the sense that, again, we're talking about planets are in the habitable zone of their star. Well, that doesn't really say exactly how far they are or how close they are. It doesn't say exactly what the mass is. And it ignores a lot of other parameters that are also necessary for life.
It gets a bunch of planets into the equation.
Yes.
And then you
have
to look more closely. And this is what the Drake equation tries to tell us.
Yeah, to an extent.
To an extent.
Yeah. So in any case, then let's move on a little
bit
here.
So we're flying.
One of the things I really want to get at is this problem of abiogenesis.
I would love to talk about abiogenesis
with you.
I'm not sure we're going to get past abiogenesis, but we could try.
I'm hoping that we will. But Yeah, so a great deal of conversation about life in the universe revolves around this question of how life gets started. It's one of the most complex pieces of the puzzle. And abiogenesis is the concept of life arising from non-living material. So it's an incredibly...
We've never seen this.
Yeah, you're right. And although people would say, well, it happened on Earth. You know, if you look at it from a purely naturalistic perspective...
But you have to carry in your naturalistic presupposition.
Explanation would be is that, well, it happened here.
But so what you need to do now is you need to show me the evidence for that.
So if we can get back to the question of abiogenesis. So abiogenesis, again, it's the concept of life arising from non-living material. And if you look at the history of the Earth, then from a purely a physical, materialistic perspective, that's what appears to have happened is that there wasn't life for the very early part of the Earth's history, and then there was. So, like I say, if you're just looking at the material physical perspective, then
that's what the materialist has to posit.
That's what appears happened from that perspective. So it is an incredibly complex question, and it's one of the greatest scientific mysteries to this day. And in general, scientists agree that four basic steps would be needed in order for this to happen. So first, starting from simple inorganic compounds, like small organic molecules or monomers, such as amino acids and nucleic acid bases would have to form, okay? So you have to start with these small organic molecules, okay?
How complex are these things?
Well, we talked earlier before the show about the Miller-Urey experiment and getting amino acids together, and that in itself is, you know, not a really simple feat. So again, we have to start off with the organic molecules, and then secondly, these have to combine to make larger biomolecules or polymers such as proteins, RNA, and lipids, which are more complex yet. And the third step is that these would have to self-organize by a variety of interactions into a pre-cellular, semi-alive system, if you will, inside of a vesicle or a membrane-enclosed compartment. So this would be a pre-cellular system. And then fourth, these would then have to gradually transform into a more sophisticated self-replicating living organism. And so each one of these steps is extremely complex. And this is what would have to happen, though. This chain of events, each of which are extremely complex, would have to happen in order to get living material from non-living matter.
And we're not talking about technologically advanced.
No.
We're just talking simple.
Right. We're talking just to get a single living cell.
Yeah.
Okay. So that gives you an idea, at least, of how complex the process is to get just even a single living cell to begin with. So in the time that's remaining, if we could kind of look at the arguments on both sides. So on one hand, we have the life is common arguments. Okay, so we kind of have these two camps, really. One says that life is common. The other side would say life is rare. So if we look at the arguments on the side of life is common, we have Christian De Duve, who's a Belgian biologist and Nobel Prize winner.
De Duve.
Yes, it is so very Belgian, isn't it?
It is very Belgian.
And he's famous for calling life a cosmic imperative. And this is his quote where he says that most biologists today tend to see life and mind as cosmic imperatives written into the very fabric of the universe rather than an extraordinarily improbable product of chance. But he also stated that life is either a reproducible, almost commonplace manifestation of matter given certain conditions or a miracle. Too many steps are involved to allow for something in between. So he admits it's either commonplace,
Yeah.
Just as a manifestation of matter. And, you know, even the verbiage that he uses in terms of it being written into the very fabric of the universe begs the question of who wrote it there.
That's right.
Right? So,
so it's one extreme or the other is what he's saying.
In a sense. But again, like I say, even if you go with the extreme that it's commonplace and written into the fabric of the universe, again, that begs the question of who wrote it there.
Yeah.
Right? It begs an intelligence.
Yeah.
Right? So... so anyway, this idea that life is common is it boils down into that same thing. Either, you know, the idea, many of the life is common proponents would say that, well, it happened once, so it could happen again. And so since we have so little time left, I'd kind of quickly like to look at the life is rare arguments, on the other hand. And so, for example, we have Russian-born American molecular biologist Eugene Koonin, who states that the origin of life field is a failure. We still do not have even a plausible, coherent model, let alone a validated scenario for the emergence of life on Earth. Certainly, this is due not to lack of experimental and theoretical effort, but to the extraordinary intrinsic difficulty and complexity of the problem. A succession of exceedingly unlikely steps is essential for the origin of life. From the synthesis and accumulation of nucleotides to the origin of translation, through the multiplication of probabilities, these make the final outcome seem almost like a miracle. And he goes on to say that for chance alone to produce another inhabited planet, we need another 10 to the 500 universes.
Yeah.
Not just galaxies or planets, but universes.
10 to the 500.
Yeah, 10 to the 500 additional universes.
So just so you guys know, listening, if you're listening right now, that's the smallest number we've referenced tonight. 10 to the 500. And it's not in reference to stars. It's not in reference to planets or galaxies. It's to universes.
Crazy.
And how many universes do we know exist right now?
One.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, it is kind of amazing. I mean, you start looking at, again, these are the two main arguments. The life is common side basically says, well, it happened once, so it's probably common. The other side would say, yeah. And again, it's
it
a
makes
sample.
No sense.
Well, it's a sample size of one. They're basically saying, okay, it happened on the Earth one time. And so it's really, you're right, a nonsensical argument. And on the other side is this acknowledgement of how incredibly complex it is and how improbable it would be for life to arise just even once, let alone twice or more.
Or more.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah, crazy. I wish we had more time to talk about it. There's so much more to say.
There is so much more to say. Well, we haven't even gotten to the like theological implications.
Right,
and stuff
exactly.
Like that.
And that's something that my students really enjoyed talking about.
That's a really interesting conversation to me. But like one of the things that I can take away from all of this stuff, and if you're listening, guys, like one of the things that you can take away from this stuff is that God is so good, and he is creative, and he created us unique, and he created us special. And as far as science goes, that's confirming of these things, mm-hmm. that we're rare.
Yeah.
And so rare, in fact, that we don't detect anything like us, anywhere in the vastness of space.
On the flip side of that, you know, I mean, we read in John 3:16 that God so loved the cosmos, that world is cosmos, right? That he sent his only son, right? And so to me, that tells me that if God created other imago Dei beings elsewhere in the universe, then Christ was sent for them as well.
Yeah. And one of the things that oftentimes I feel like we overlook is we preach a truncated gospel in many regards, but one of the ways that we don't do this, we don't recognize that the gospel is full orbed in that it's not just the restoration of humanity, it's the restoration of all of creation.
Exactly.
And that means every single star, every single planet, every single anything, molecule, every single molecule in this universe is going to be restored to its proper place and function upon Christ's return. And that's like, I mean, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Well, at the same time, I mean, with regard to this topic, you know, I feel like you know, my God's big enough to have created other intelligent beings elsewhere.
And, interesting.
And I'm kind of excited that, you know, maybe there is intelligent life elsewhere. And if there is, I know that God created them.
Next time, like, we're in studio, because I think next month you're not in studio, so we have a guest on. It's going to be awesome. But the month after that, we should pick up this conversation, the theological implications of life out there.
That'd be cool.
Because it'd be really, really fun. Because we are about to wrap up, guys. And if you've been listening, that means you've been listening to almost a full hour of Apologetics.com radio, where we challenge believers to think and thinkers to believe. Tonight is Science Night. We're sponsored by the ASA, the American Scientific Affiliation. You can go to ASA3.org, ASA3.org, and you can get tons of free resources, but it doesn't stop there. You don't have to just read this stuff and interact with it on the internet. You can get personal and up close with these people who actually write these articles. You can go to their conference in Wheaton this summer, and you can sign up on the ASA's website. And I'm John Noyes. I'm with Dr. Leslie Wickman, who's unbelievable. You're incredible. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm not having you. You're having me. Hey, guys, you know what? You listen to Apologetics.com radio. We can't wait to hear from you next week, and that's when we're going to be back next week. So have a good night. Bye-bye.